Welcome to Neuland, the podcast of the Hasso-Plattner Institute. Here's our fourth episode featuring the final panel from the AI at HPI conference for you to listen to. This time, the topic is the role of ethical practices for AI across industries. The panel features Dr. Bettina Laugwitz, Director of AI Ethics and Responsible AI at SAP, Jens Redmer, Principal for New Products at Google, Christiane Mietke, Senior Manager for AI Communication and Policy at Infineon Technologies, and Franziska Weindauer, CEO of TÜV AI Lab. The discussion is moderated by Professor Max Senges from the Institute of Electronic Business. And now let's dive into the final episode of our podcast series on the AI at HPI conference.
We basically have three parts in the conversation. That's what we discussed before. In the beginning, you already heard the commonalities, but also the USPs in how these principles and key AI ethic requirements are implemented. Maybe also elaborating a little bit on the specialties of the multidisciplinarity that is needed to make that work. Of course, as mentioned, Bettina and Christiane first, and then if Jens and Franziska want to add. In the second part, we want to go a bit deeper into ethical dilemmas. Ethics is not a clear-cut environment. When you do one thing, you might have an interesting correlation and a negative effect on another. So questions about ethical dilemmas are second. And then last but not least, we're going to go very clearly on the EU AI Act and the requirements that pose practical and organizational challenges. Now, after each of those sections, I'm going to open it up to you so you don't have to wait until the end if a question comes up. And without further ado, I would pass the microphone first to Bettina.
Okay, thanks, Max, also for the very comprehensive introduction. I'm very impressed. what I've been doing in all those years at SAP, and yes, indeed, on a personal note, working in all those different areas that Max mentioned is a good preparation to work in AI ethics now, because as you also pointed out just now, it's a very multidisciplinary and multi-perspective topic. I wanted to start describing a little bit the approach to AI ethics at SAP. Most of you have probably listened to the keynote by Philipp Herzig, our AI chief AI officer earlier, who has lined out and illustrated what we do in great detail. Still, for the context of this panel, I will summarize briefly and add my or our team's perspective to this. From a historical perspective, SAP has been working in machine learning, applying machine learning in applications for some time. Also, a couple of years ago, SAP has defined and committed to guiding principles for the ethics of AI. Maybe it was a bit later than Google, but not much. Considerable time. In 2016, if I'm not mistaken, the EU Commission has appointed a high-level expert group to define guidelines for trustworthy AI. Also in that group, colleagues from SAP were present and were part of the definition process. Since then, AI ethics has been implemented step by step at SAP. We have a policy in place, AI ethics policy, that is binding for all teams working on the development of AI systems. We have now moved, as Philip also mentioned, from our proprietary guiding principles to commit to the UNESCO guiding principles. And from a practical note, it's great to have this framework that is globally accepted as our background. And if you look into those principles, it's 10 principles, and those principles that relate to the requirements towards AI systems are very much in line with what has been defined by the high-level expert group in 2016. And the last point I want to make before Max is sitting on my lap is that our history with AI ethics and AI compliance in the context of EU is also why we are not surprised that what is coming to us as a company in terms of requirements with the EU AI Act, because we've been part of that journey towards EU AI Act over the last years, and also with the you saw the approach to risk assessment and handling different risk levels differently. We are also on a good path to be ready for EU AI Act approach and compliance.
Christiane brings a different perspective in several ways. I want to point out she's the only representative of a company that produces hardware, right? That is a completely different, not a different ball game maybe, but there are certainly differences that I'm sure you're going to point out. I want to encourage you to raise your hand. There's two people on the sides that can pass you a microphone. So we're going to have the first break with audience interaction after Christiane. Christiane, please.
Yes, thank you very much. So yes, indeed, we do have a different perspective. And you might wonder, so why is Infineon as a hardware producer on this panel? Why are we interested in responsible AI? Why is this really important for us? And let's start with talking about what do we do with regards to AI. We always say we have three areas. We power AI, we enable and provide AI, and we use AI internally. So let's start with the first one, we power AI. What we do is we produce the very efficient power modules that can make data centers more sustainable. And I think this is really crucial because, especially when we talk about ethics in AI, if you look into the UI Act, the sustainability issue is not very prominent most of the time. And I think this is really something we have to talk more about. The second aspect in AI is we enable and provide AI. That means here we talk about the realm of edge AI. So that's AI that runs on the devices themselves, which has a couple of advantages. Sustainability is one of them. Those models, by definition, are very small. They have to fit on a small chip. So they are more efficient, energy efficient. This is also an advantage in terms of privacy by design, because the data remains on the device itself. It's not sent to the cloud. There cannot be any data accumulation and so on. So you, as the owner of that device, you can keep your data. And the third aspect is just faster. Again, there's no back and forth in the cloud. So Infineon, we help our customers to develop this kind of AI systems, and we also have our own models that we provide. So that's the second part. The third part, we use AI in all our business processes, from chip design to manufacturing to sales and marketing. And of course, again here, sustainability plays a huge role, because if you think of manufacturing, you can make a lot of energy and resource efficiency gains with AI. So now when we look at responsible AI and sustainable AI, for us, most of the time, it's not this nice to have that, you know, if you have time, you can think about this ethics stuff as well. No, it's quality. Responsible AI is a quality requirement. And this is why we really look into all our AI systems in that regard, independent if they are high risk or not. Because if you look at an AI prototype and you say, yeah, I can quickly prototype this, of course, yeah, you can do it quick and dirty. But if you really want to scale it in a manufacturing environment, or if you want to implement it as a safety component in a car, you better make sure that it is safe, that it is secure, that it is robust, that it doesn't have bias. And I think in our world, we very often, we are used to, in a way, we have heard this example before, we're used to fly and have certain safety requirements. We're used to have toys and make sure that, and we can somehow rely most of the time that our kids can take those toys and play with them safely. Or when we have electrical devices and so on, we have the standards of quality. And I think we just have to do the same with AI.
Thank you so much, Christiane. So are there any first questions to those representatives out there? I see a question over here and one over there. I think two questions are good. Ah, okay, I didn't see. Happy to start here. Then we do three, please be concise.
Maybe a follow-up to your current statement. So you said for toys for kids, we have safety guarantees. And maybe the question goes to Franziska Weinauer for the TÜV, I think. I'm really proud if I go outside Germany, I see the TÜV seal somewhere. We have certificates, right? So how is your vision on certificates for AI, and can we really ensure trust by these certificates maybe in the near future?
Well, there's the compliance aspect. So we have to test AI by mid-2027. We need to be able, as TÜV companies, to test cars and to test AI in cars, which is, extremely complex. CAS is one of the most complex AI tools we can look at, because there are around 100 AI systems interacting with each other. So you need to make sure that every AI system is safe and the systems together are safe. Which is super difficult, and I think what we're lacking at the moment are standardized testing frameworks for AI, and our vision is to create these testing frameworks until 2027. So we need to be testing ready until then, because then we need to be ready, because then products are going to enter the market and there is a certification necessity, right? There is there is no choice for manufacturers, so they need to get their car through TÜV or their medical device through TÜV. Or any other testing company. So that's really crucial. And I hope also these standard practices are going to be used in other companies as well, right? We heard from Infineon why it's so relevant for them, but they don't absolutely have to do it. But I think every company should implement these good practices and have safe and trustworthy AI by design.
So just to be precise, you say you start in Germany first, you need to get the basics in order before you follow his request to promote these best practices internationally.
Now, I hope that the harmonized standards on EU level and our testing practices are going to be spread across the globe, right? I'm really, that was the vision I presented. We're hoping that we're going to be the forerunners in trustworthy AI, and we're going to be the first to have these practices, right? It's super difficult. It's an area of research, and there are a lot of super qualified researchers in Europe. And I think we need to spread these practices around the world, and we're going to see AI blowing up everywhere, and I'm going to hope that we're going to be the safe space in Europe like we are for toys, for baby milk, for whatever.
Cool. Let's try to be as interactive. If you want to pick up the mic, make a contribution, just give me a signal. We have someone here in the middle of the room. If you could please state your name or whatever and whatever affiliation you're comfortable sharing.
Yeah, Jobst Heitzig from Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. So this is also for TÜV and maybe for Google, because Waymo belongs to. So if we think of highly autonomous systems such as self-driving cars, then it seems that ethics goes beyond mere safety. So for example, if I have a very autonomous system, should it be based on what type of ethical system should it even be based? Should it be something like consequentialism, utilitarianism? Should it be something like virtue ethics or deontology? Or should it just be trained on human annotations like in the moral machine survey? I'd be interested in your take on this.
Thank you.
The interesting thing with some of the autonomous vehicle technology, and I can only speak for Google, Waymo is now a sister company within Alphabet. Some of this technology is asking questions to the engineers that society can today not answer. And you mentioned this great example of moral machine. For those who don't know it, it's an experiment, I think, by Harvard University, where different scenarios of self-driving cars, not related to Google, not related to Waymo, were given to participants and said, in this example, a self-driving car has two options. One is it can run over two criminals, and the second option is it could run over two kids, and where should it go? That's a question that society today, for very good reasons, is not able to answer. And the same question is asked now to companies, to engineers that have to answer the same question. Our typical answer as a company, and again, I'm not a representative for Waymo. Our typical answer is, we design these systems so that they don't run into these scenarios, so that before they actually have to make a collision, they are as defensive as they can get in order to avoid these scenarios. But it doesn't answer the moral, the ethics question, which still is a dilemma. And we get to dilemmas in a second, I'm told.
Well, and I do have to say, as a philosopher and ethics academic, that is not a fair question, right? It's actually a flawed experiment, if you ask me, because it's asking the impossible, right? I mean, obviously, both options are bad, and lives should not be compared, whether it's old people or young people. There is a very intense debate about that framing of the question as, you know, this is not the decision that any machine or human, by the way, would make, right? You do whatever you feel in that very moment, and it's not guided by ethical principles. There is one more question over there, or did you want to come in, Francisca?
Just really quickly, I think we need to shift to, we have a standard testing procedure, and we put a hailstorm on solar panels to make sure that they don't break under a hailstorm, right. And we have X amount of kilogram we put on there, looking at the, it's called the assurance case method, right? So we look at how the deployer of the system or the designer argues why he made a specific ethics choice, and then we look at did he argue that case well? Because if we look at fairness, we have like 36 different fairness metrics, and you need to choose in every circumstance which metric to choose, which metric is right for the use case. So I think we need to, you know, shift the, okay, we have a standard procedure to, okay, how did the deployer argue his case, and is that in line with our cultural principles, basically?
Thank you. Well, there's a last question in this first round.
Yes, Ralph Hincher from NVIDIA. My question actually goes in the same direction as the first speaker. If we take, for example, a neural network which is capable of detecting German traffic signs, it basically doesn't make sense for every car manufacturer in the world to start from scratch and train his own network. So my question would be, is there any plan for a TÜV certified stamp on a trustworthy trained network? Every car manufacturer could buy in a shop and won't have to do all this development by himself. And expanding that into the future, will there be a library of pre-trained primitive tasks which we can actually buy as we would buy apps in a store for our mobile phones?
Thank you so much, Francisca. I think you're triggering the inspiration in people of what your institution might be able to do.
That's actually a business model that we've been considering, right? In the future. I think not right now, but that's actually something we're thinking about. And I think we cannot especially also underestimate the relevance of test data sets, right? And having, you know, sealed test data sets you could use as a manufacturer to test your models against, for example. But I think that, I mean, we would love to cooperate with Mercedes or whoever and give them a stamp so we can sell the model together. I think it's a great idea.
All right, thank you. I know there was one more question. Let's take this one in the second round. Let's get to the actual dilemmata, right? I've started many, many years ago with human rights for internet governance, and there is no clear cut between freedom of expression and data privacy, right? One is always, or not always, but many times in conflict with the other. Similarly, with these ethical questions, right? It's impossible that there is no negative side if you have to balance the two, as we've heard many times. Are there any examples that you can think of where in your work, in your teams, you've run into weighing different options, and how does that actually happen?
Dilemma, Philipp Herzig mentioned one earlier, and I think it's coming up also in other contexts. It's yeah, you have maybe two ethical perspectives that are in conflict, but for anyone who's trying to sell AI systems or making money with AI systems, you have the dilemma between functionality, full functionality, and restrictions through ethical guardrails. Yeah? Like, for example, the content filtering capability is supposed to avoid that discriminatory, for example, is one aspect, avoid discriminatory content coming to the end user. This means that there is not necessarily every information that is available for the system is then made available for the person. For example, in the human resources area, also in there is a role-based approach that you have to take. Yeah, so salary data for an employee or other sensitive data should be available for the HR advisor, and should. Parts of that should also be available for the people manager, but should not be available for the peer in the team. Yeah, so you have to, in order to protect the personal data of a person, you have to look at the situation very specifically to balance out what kind of protection is needed, and at the same time what information to ensure the functionality and the utility of the AI system. I think there is no silver bullet. You cannot make all systems really safe in all contexts, but I think it's really important to emphasize you have to look to give the system the context by, for example, defining roles and assigning roles so that the system knows how is the level of protection that is needed in a certain context.
Thank you so much, Bettina. Jens, I saw you want to come in as well. Christiane, you're also invited. And I want to ask both of you if you could help us kind of look inside the decision-making process, right? Is it an open debate? Is there a very structured process where people can highlight cases internally? How does it actually happen?
Yes, maybe I start with commenting on the kind of dilemmas that we look. And I think from my point of view, there's one major dilemma. I would call it the automation dilemma, because you, of course, with AI, you can automate all kinds of processes. And then we can always say, yes, there has to be a human in the loop, but we have to be clear that to a certain extent, a human will not be able to always completely have an oversight of an AI system, especially when it's about like complex data structures, and then there's one result, and then a human will not go and try to like manually check this, like the results. This is impossible, right? And I think there, it's really a question: what do we want to automate? What do we not? Where does it make sense that AI can play a crucial role? And if you look at cars, for instance, also like this is like a very critical question. I mean, we can have virtual sensors, for instance, where AI takes over like work of a sensor, but sometimes we want to have that, sometimes we might not want to have this. And I think these are the kind of questions where there is no real answer, like there's no real always a right or wrong on a higher level. It is really use case specific. And this use case has to be looked in. There has to be a risk management system in the sense that there is clear what the risks are and that there are mitigation methods applied. And yeah, the way we do this, I mean, we have a governance process that starts with the AI risk classification, where we look in the EU Act risk classification, but we also look at further risks these systems may take. And then the second process is what we call responsible AI management. So requirements are set, and they're set on a use case basis because they cannot be like generalized. And we check, are these requirements fulfilled or not? And depending on how risky the use case is, this kind of check will be more involved in discussions and debates. And if the risk is like on a lower level, the developers can have more freedom to argue their own case.
Allow me one, digging into this question. So is it actually an open process where you know, stakeholders from across the board are invited to wade in and report cases and deliberate what the classification should be, or is it a structural process where, you know, somebody makes a proposal and then, you know, the different categories of stakeholders comment on it, and then there is a decision process to label the risk category, for example, of a certain dilemma of an ethical case?
It starts with a very structural process and a questionnaire, actually. And then if there are those cases where you need discussions and debates, we have something that we call the responsible AI board with representatives from different aspects in the company, and then it gets a discussion.
Okay. Thank you so much. It's actually nice, Jens, that you come last, because Google, I think, is a very open case where the company discussion internally is hot, to say the least. And there have been cases where Googlers have left the company and openly criticized. And I actually think that is a very strong sign of company culture. And it's difficult to manage these controversial discussions. So it would be really interesting to hear how you perceive that and what the best practices are.
And it's a painful process at times. And I think it's a great democratic, and it's the democratic process, and it helps to build better products. I have two examples of dilemmata within the AI principle implementation that I explained earlier. So these AI principles, they don't work if they just are put on paper and everybody hangs a nice picture frame behind them in their desk. That doesn't help. So you need to really change the company, how people understand things like bias in developing products. How do you change the implementation process in product management from an early stage idea to a product that is launched potentially to billions of people? Every single one of these steps has now added checkboxes, added marks, added internal discussions and debates, some of them heated, as you alluded to. And I give you two examples of sometimes how easy it is and sometimes how difficult it is. An easy example is where the AI principles departments is seen as a helpful advisor and not as an auditor. One example in the easy way is when we relaunched the Android camera app, so the camera app that uses the camera and takes photos on your Android phone, some people found in the ethics department, they asked a couple of questions. Have you considered all diversities in your application? And the product manager said, what do you mean? Because they found out that the white balance for the exposure determination of the camera was somehow unintentionally optimized for white people. So, you know, dark-colored people of different ethnicities didn't get the perfect exposure. The product manager said, that is fantastic feedback. I take this so I can make my product better, and I can reach more users, I can make this more successful. So everybody was happy in this. That's the easy way of things. It can get really difficult with specific applications. We had ample examples. One example that I find interesting is Gemini. When we created Gemini, our version of ChatGPT, in the beginning it could not create code. That was still under development. So the public version underwent, before it went public, very intense tests of what you could do with it, what the implications were, what the bugs were, what potential disclaimers we needed to take down. And the product managers were happy they had launched their product. All of a sudden, they said, we're now ready to launch a new feature. Gemini can also now not only create text and images and stuff, it can also create code, programming code that you can use to, at scale, create program, executable program code. So the principals department said, we need to have a new review. This is something really substantially, fundamentally new that you add to your product. And there was an intense debate, but people said, we have already tested our product. We have said we have created different use cases. Code generation was on the in the pipeline. We already mentioned it, so this was tested. Don't make us go through this process again, because it is painful at times, because you need to have a lot of discussions, you need to involve a lot of people, both internal and external. The more ethical some questions become, the more challenging it becomes. And that is an example, when you're coming closer, I know, that is an example where things become more heated and the discussions become more intense. And we have even further examples. So the balance of making this self-inflicted set of principles work in the company is really important, and we love this debate, and it's as much work as it is, it really leads to better services and better products.
Thank you. I have one more question, then I'm going to open it up to the room again, and the question is about learning, right? As we all know, we humans are good learners, but we learn by looking at others. If there's role models, you know, that is a very good way of learning. Nevertheless, learning almost always involves failure, right? It involves making mistakes. So how does your organization think about making mistakes and contributing to an environment where we can openly discuss that and learn together, potentially? Anybody?
Okay, I'll be brave. So we are all in this in this journey together, right? I mean, machine learning is not something that has been invented yesterday. Yeah, it's been around for some time, but the pace of development is so fast. At least since ChatGPT, I don't have to tell you all that, but. This means that we really need to learn together, and we need to have humans in the loop on all levels. Yeah, so in the development, in the application itself, but also in the organization. And from my perspective, how our process is working with the high risk cases that are being identified, and. Sometimes because there are dilemmata, sometimes because certain criteria apply. What we are really doing is learning with those critical cases by bringing them and discussing them in our AI ethics steering committee. This is the place where You have heard that representatives, managers from all board areas sit together, including also diversity and inclusion, data protection, privacy, and so on, and are looking into the critical cases, discussing them, bringing the feedback back to the development teams. Development teams make a proposal how to approach that solution that has been proposed. Is it possible? Is it not? And this interaction, this discussion, is really the basis for us all learning from the challenges that we are faced with.
Thank you so much, Bettina. Jens, you've raised your hand.
Yeah, I think, as I mentioned in my introductory talk, I think the biggest failure, the biggest mistake is not to start using stuff. You need to experiment. You will make mistakes along the way. And yeah, probably a good idea if you don't repeat too big of a mistake. So you need to make conscious decisions, but people need to be trying out things. Even within Google, it's sometimes difficult to keep up with the fast pace of development of how features and products are spat out of companies in our industry. But it cannot be that if you ask any Googler what is your favorite productivity gain example, how do you use AI in your own productivity world? If you stare into a blank face, then that cannot be. So people need to be trained. Even within our company, we need to continuously encourage people to try out new things, and this is something that, as I already alluded to, every individual needs to try out, and you need to find out your case. What is your case of how do you use some of these tools? Because in the end, it doesn't really matter whether it's AI or generative AI or whatever you call it, or quantum computing. It's a new sort of tool that will become an integral part of everyday life, even in academic institutions. Just last week, I was at an open day at a university in the Netherlands with my son, who's going to study next year. And one of the deans of the economics department said, we have courses where people actively are encouraged to use all of the tools that they can that they can access. We're not going to forbid the use of ChatGPT and Gemini and all these tools. We're going to encourage people to do that. We're also going to encourage people to abide by the highest academic standards. So if you use one of these tools, make sure that you quote correctly. Make sure that you are telling people that you have used these tools. But you need to be able to understand these tools. Don't forbid them. You know, encourage people to use and understand them and make the mistakes along the way.
Reminds me of the saying, you're not going to be replaced by AI, but by someone who will be able to use AI. Right?
And I think that's important for society. You know, you don't want to even spread society further apart into those people that are technically savvy to try out some of these tools, and those people who, for some reason, do not try out these tools.
Franziska, Christiane, I have you kind of on a high note for next contribution, but we want to bring the audience in. Please introduce yourself.
Yeah. Good morning. I'm Felix Blind. I'm a programmer from AMI, and I'm left over from the last round, but I didn't hear anything that addresses that. So you said that you need to leave the testing model and go to the assurance model. I wonder why. Didn't the testing model serve us well? We saw in the last presentation or a former presentation how, for example, SAP is testing its bias. Isn't that something the TÜV should do at the end of, because you also need to protect my employees. They will, check the checkbox and say, yes, of course I thought of that, and I thought of that, and I have an ethics officer that should think of that and that. And also Volkswagen has probably people who assures you that they thought of having some diesel thing in place, but you should test it. That's the thing of TÜV, no?
And sure. Yeah. I think there was, if I may, I think that's sort of a misunderstanding. I didn't say don't need to test. You need to test in the end, but you need to choose. You have a huge variety of testing methods, and you can't always use the same method for X. For X testing dimension, that's something that has a new quality, because if you're testing robustness, I mean, you have an amount of metrics you can use, right? But you, in a lot of cases, you can use the same. And if you look at fairness, I think you have even more metrics, like I said, some 30s, 40 metrics, and you need to argue why you chose that metric, right? And that's, you need to argue more why you chose a certain test method. And in a lot of other fields where TÜV is coming in and testing, you always use the same testing method in the same case, right? And with ethics, or ethical criteria, you have more choice and you need to argue more. That's why I said that, you know, normally you have a norm where it's stated if you want to test the car brakes for safety, you do this and this test, and that's your benchmark, that's your threshold, this is the test needs to, or the car needs to reach in, or the brake needs to reach in this testing scenario. And we won't have that for AI because the use cases are so different, and there will, in the norms, I'm pretty convinced, the norms are drafted right now, but I'm pretty convinced that we won't have harmonized thresholds for AI systems in these norms because it's so difficult to have them and to have standardized benchmarks, for example. But that doesn't mean we don't need to test. We just need to argue more why we test it in a certain way and whether the result that's come out is okay.
And just to maybe elaborate for a moment on the differences, right? The AI systems are not deterministic in the same way that the Newtonian software engineering architectures were. So, right, you can test, of course you have to test, but the systems are dynamic. And especially if you have several of them interacting, it's a continuous monitoring and an assurance model. I think this is where you came
from. And if I may quickly jump in, we've all been talking that we have this interdisciplinary boards, or and I think the reason why this is really crucial and really important is because you don't have this one decision, you have this one matrix and say, yes, if I apply this, the AI system will be whatever fair. There has to be a discussion, a decision, what means fairness in this context? Is it like only gender, or is it like as a social biases and so on? And I think this is what we have to get used to, in that sense, the mixture of critical thinking, also social science, and the technical realm.
And what is our expectation level, right? I mean, humans make car accidents all the time, right? And we expect the autonomous driving to be perfect from day one. I see some challenges there that are just very, very high expectations when it comes to these digital products.
Hello, my name is Christina Klaas. I'm from Ernst Abbe Hochschule Jena. I have a short information. Because you mentioned skilling before, and you also mentioned that the dilemma discussion is a painful and democratic process, okay? I'm a member of the computer ethics group of the German Informatics Society, and we believe that everybody must learn to identify dilemma and to discuss. And for this reason, we have developed over 90 case scenarios for whatever educational settings. You can use them in 90 minutes with team meetings, whatever. Over 10 are translated in English, and I will leave our address of the website at the counter, just if you want to look at them.
Thank you so much. There's one more question over here, and Then we're going to get into the final rounds.
Hello, my name is Joel Stordenhoft. I'm from Fujitsu. And I would be interested in what kind of role you see of AI within the creation process of an ethical value chain argumentation and its auditing.
Do you see any? Can you elaborate for a moment what that is, an ethical value chain?
So, if I understood correctly, you do not, from the question that the man here in the middle asks, you do not look at the method that is used to do the ethical assessment, but you look at the argumentation of whether this was what was implemented is the right thing based on ethical decisions that were taken. Do you see within this kind of creation of the argumentation of the ethical journey that you take within the decisions a role of AI, as well as in the auditing?
So AI as an advisor cool. for the ethical yeah. Decisions?
I think, interesting question, yes. And then we need to be certified as well, because these tools might be high risk. That's also a joke that's been been made in the TÜV universe. No, I think yes, there will be a tool, a role for AI, but I think we're far away from using AI for ethical scenarios. At the moment, where we're using AI to assess, for example, if you assess a power plant in China, Volkswagen power plant producing cars, you need to check the CVs of all the people working there, whether what they do is what they've been qualified for. For example, AI is used to check the CVs, or AI is used to check the technical documentation of the manufacturer. So really, at the moment, more basic AI use cases, but I think we'll, as we, you know, as time moves on, we're going to be more advanced. And I think TÜV is, I need to say also self-critically, is not leading AI adoption, right? So we're, I think, as a lot of other German companies, not we as a lab, but we're an independent startup, right? We're a bit different, but I think the TÜV companies on the whole, there are 5 in Germany, 25,000 people working in each of the bigger ones. I think they're lagging as well with regards to AI.
I find this question really interesting, because one of the strengths of AI, of generative AI, is to find creative, additional, unusual approaches toward existing questions. So it could very well be a tool, one of the tools, and if you work on high risk tools, and it needs to be certified and everything. But it could create really unusual questions. And I think for that reason, it could be very helpful to consider this. If you think about some of the existing use cases where people challenge their pitches, where startups send their pitches to a generative AI and say, imagine you are a very critical venture capitalist. What are the 10 most critical questions that you're going to ask me for my pitch? Where's my weakness in my argumentation line? Those are the really strong use cases for generative AI. It's not replacing search. It's finding creative ways, and it's analyzing existing content. So for this particular implementation, that could be helpful.
I believe there are really studies out there that how AI is used in risk management to come up with additional risk scenarios that a human might not have thought of, which then has a challenge that it's a lot of risks probably. Then it's a really the challenge for the developer to kind of really understand all of them and go through and evaluate them. But yes, yeah, it can be helpful.
All right. I think we're slowly but surely getting to the time crush and finished. I've been asked by the organizers to not only facilitate a lively conversation, but also to be the thorns in your back. So I have one challenging question, I guess, for you before we get to a final round where everybody can sum up their arguments and share a look forward. So we've all seen greenwashing before. And I believe there is a fair case to be made that everybody wants to be ethical with AI and that there is an AI ethics washing happening. What would you say, especially as the companies, but maybe Franziska, you have a view here as well, what would be meaningful and needed monitoring and enforcement methods when it comes to actually checks and balances for ethics in AI? You're the brave one, Martina.
I just realized. I think transparency is key. Yeah, so you can claim everything, but customers, society, stakeholders will ask for some kind of evidence. So yes, you can say we are ethical, but expect that that stakeholders will ask for evidence there. What is challenging right now from that perspective is that there is no globally accepted certification framework in place. Yeah? No standard that is globally accepted. I mean, if you look into the different frameworks that are available, they are very similar. And I think, I would guess if you comply with one of them, it's good enough for now, right? The challenge is which one to pick, which one is the suitable, the most fitting framework for your business or for your application area. So in that sense, yes, you can try. Ethical greenwashing kind of thing, and it's no standards available. Still, I guess you have to expect that people will ask questions and there will be,
Thank you, Bettina.
Yes, I would agree. I think we are at the point now where lots of companies have their values and then there's the AI Act, but we don't know really if companies comply to their own values, and we don't know yet if they will comply to the UI Act because it's not like in force, at least not the high risk requirements. So I think what is really relevant in the future are those certificates, our ratings. I mean, we have Trustpilot in the internet to rate companies, right? And I think we need something similar for AI on various levels.
Thank you so much. Jens, Franziska?
I mentioned the principles already, and it's not done by putting this at the back of your desk. You need to challenge whatever you have as principles, as value, and you need to revisit what you have because the system is ever evolving. When generative AI had this Kitty Hawk moment, when ChatGPT and OpenAI opened their models 1.5 years ago, people understood, oh my God, this is actually happening. This is something that really, really works, despite the fact that AI has been implemented in many companies for decades. And at that point, we kind of revisited our AI principles. I said, are these 7 positive use cases and 4 negative, are they still enough? Do we need to implement more? Do we need to change anything? Fortunately, we didn't need to change anything, but even if we had to, we would have done that. So you need to constantly evolve, you need to constantly challenge the status quo, and you need to be transparent about this. You mentioned already, we publish reports on the implementation of these principles in our company to give some guidance to companies that want to do similar things. We exchange with many stakeholders. So it's an ever-evolving system, so you need to challenge things.
Thanks, Jens. Franziska.
Yeah, I think at the moment AI washing is pretty easy because we don't have any, you know, binding schemes. And as you also said, there are no standard certification schemes, right? We don't have a quantifiable framework to say, okay, this is ethical or this is not ethical. So at the moment, we have all these high-level principles, G7, Hiroshima, whatever, and they're pretty high-level. So everyone can, you know, yes, of course my product is fair. Of course it's ethical, right? And not all the companies have really these teams like Google has, for example, in place that really do the testing as well. So I think it's going to become more and more difficult as time moves on. But at the moment, I think it's still pretty easy.
Thank you. So last round, I learned about a really interesting design, innovation, creative technique. Imagine there is a magical button that you can press right now that will put something in place that will make the ethics and AI scenario much more positive than you'd imagine. Something that would go away, something that would be magically possible. And as I mentioned, this is not about necessarily today, it's about 10 years out. It's about this world that we're moving towards. So if you indulge and if you're creative, if that surprising last question inspires you, please answer it or share with the audience what your outlook is, what challenges and opportunities are that you in your particular context are going to tackle next and possibly are looking for academic and other stakeholders' input to find good solutions. Franziska, you seem ready to go.
I have a magic button I want to press to find an AI tool that makes all other AI systems perfectly explainable. And I'm really hoping that we're going to have that at some point.
You stole my button.
No, I'm sorry. And I want to have a second magic button to make sure that everyone in government and in all the agencies that have to implement the AI Act have AI skills. I think that would be fantastic as well.
Thank you. Christiane?
Yeah, I would go in a similar direction. Imagine you as a consumer, you're interacting with the AI system and you can press the button and you immediately know, explain to your level of AI knowledge what precautions have been taken, what kind of fairness metrics have been implemented and why. And you can really test and prove that, not believe in like the marketing of the company.
Very nice. Jens, you've organized your thoughts.
I've organized, I've tried. I'm a very pragmatic guy. I would like my magic button to put skilling at the heads of everybody in society, from any group, any age group, from any level of education, to use whatever he or she can do with some of these tools. And I think all the follow-up questions, what you do, what you can do, what you can produce, how you can create economic benefit, how you can create societal benefit, how you approach ethical questions will come after that. If you're not trained, if you're not skilled, it doesn't make any sense to do anything. So my magic button is skilling for everybody.
Education. Bettina.
Yes, I mean, my buttons have been stolen already. Still, I want to elaborate a little on that. I think transparency is really key. Human oversight is key, and my magic button would create the possibility for every person interacting with AI to understand the implications. Where does the output come from? In the context, yeah, so really be interpretable, make sense, not overwhelming persons with unnecessary information, but really to the point. And we had the discussion earlier, heard the discussion, trustworthy, is trust a good thing or a bad thing? From my perspective, it needs to be built, AI systems need to be built so that persons have the possibility to have appropriate trust in the AI systems. Mistrust where you should not trust, but trust and let go where it is good and okay.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I thought it was a very creative panel, and I'm looking forward to more discussion over lunch and possibly in the workshop right after. Thanks to all the panelists. Great work.